for many years now, so I finally, my will is finally broken. And that is a course in medieval Jewish philosophy without emphasizing the Rambam. So if you think about it, giving a course in Jewish philosophy without overemphasizing the Rambam would be, I can't really imagine the comparison, would be a course in the history of the personal computer without mentioning Bill Gates, which, you know, it's kind of, you're taking a very large chunk out of the picture, but you know, we've given other courses in the Rambam. And the truth of the matter is that we will in fact be spending a lot of time on the Rambam, if for no other reason than to provide the counterpoints, the difference between Maimonides, let us say, and the various other opinions. That's why you'll notice the book that the main book that's assigned here is edited by Rabbi J. David Dreyf. He's actually written many works in Halakha, but this book is called With Perfect Faith. And if you look at it, what he does is he takes the 13 principles of faith of the Rambam, which are with the Rambam's formulation, and he has excerpts from many other Jewish philosophers of the medieval period in terms of what they say about it and the like. And you'll see that, of course, in many cases, obviously, they are in full agreements, but we will also see various controversies, meaning it is not as obvious as is often assumed that every aspect of the 13 principles of faith is universally agreed upon to be authoritative. There will be many aspects in which there will be machloket and different opinions and the like. So I'll be giving you a list of assignments in terms of, you know, obviously you will not be responsible for the whole work, but there will be various selections that we will be reading. In addition, there are Xeroxes that are very important, and the Xeroxes are really from two books. One is from the Chovat HaLevavot, The Duties of the Heart, and I'll describe that book shortly. And the other is from the Sefer HaKarim, The Book of Fundamentals. Much of the Sefer HaKarim has actually been produced here, but there are some chapters I wanted you to see that are not in the anthology. In addition, you have the Kuzari, which in a way I regret a little bit because much of the Kuzari that I want you to read is in the Blythe book anyway. However, there is an advantage in that Kuzari. That is a new translation that was just prepared in the past 2 or 3 years, and there's some good footnotes, and it's a much better flowing translation than the old one. So although a lot of it may duplicate within the Blythe book, but there is a certain utility to the Kuzari. Okay, so let me first start off with what do we mean by, you know, Voltaire used to say about the Holy Roman Empire, that it was neither holy nor Roman, nor was it much of an empire. And if we give a course in medieval Jewish philosophy, let's just define our terms, just a very, very simple level. What exactly is the medieval period, right? The medieval period, known as the Middle Ages. For much of Christian Europe, this period was also known as the Dark Ages. Much of Christian Europe, France, Germany, was shrouded in ignorance. There was very, very little scientific progress, etc. Most of the European populations were, I'm talking about the Christian populations, were illiterate. And in fact, the main centers of culture in the world were the Arabic cultures of North Africa and the like, which were the only repositories, with very rare exceptions, of the philosophy of the ancient world. Plato, Aristotle, and the like, essentially were kept by the Arabic cultures, the Islamic cultures. Contrary to the image of the Islamic cultures today, which are mired in fundamentalism and the like, during this medieval period, they were really the pinnacle of the secular wisdom, secular knowledge, both in science and philosophy. And I should emphasize that in the ancient world, there was not a sharp dichotomy. There was no distinction at all, really, between philosophy and science. Philosophy was considered to be a branch of science. And thus, when you open up Plato or Aristotle, they could be talking about metaphysical issues of God and the like on one page, and then they'll be talking about how to classify animals on the other page. It was a continuum of knowledge. And consequently, what we have is, we will find that much of the great Jewish philosophers, and with this we include Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, we include the Rambam, just to mention two, came out of the Arabic milieu. In other words, the Rambam did not read Aristotle in Greek. The Rambam read Aristotle in Arabic. And all of the great works of the Greek philosophers were translated in Arabic, and that is how the Jewish philosophers largely learned them and were able to deal with them and respond to them and the like. So the great medieval period of Jewish philosophy in particular extends from around the 7th century, around the 600s, to approximately the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, which was in 1492. So you're dealing basically with 600 to 1500. That's a pretty long period of time. That's a 900-year period, and that was the period of what we of this course, of the basic works in Jewish philosophy. We will see what exactly happened after 1492 that kind of changed the emphasis and orientation of Jewish philosophical works, particularly it was the rise of Kabbalah and later the rise of Hasidut later, which really changed the rationalist impulse of the philosophy of the Middle Ages, but we'll get into that as we go on. Now, Jewish philosophy, that's medieval, time frame 600 to approximately 1500, which is also the beginning of the Renaissance and the like.
An exceptional
yeah.
There was a period of almost a century and a half that Jews were forbidden to be Jewish in North Africa. And during the period of the Rambam.
Yes.
Okay, and they had to convert, but in hiding they were Jewish.
Right, well, yeah, the Almohad persecutions, yes, that's very true. But there were various, as you know, the Rambam himself, the Rambam's family, wandered from place to place. They even lived in Israel for a short while in order to escape those persecutions. So you're correct, the notion of Islamic tolerance was not as extensive as one might assume, but at least for a large period of that time, in terms of the preservation of general culture, the Arab world were the repositories of that culture and that knowledge. So by Jewish philosophy, we mean in particular the explication of Jewish belief and practice by means of emphasizing general philosophic concepts and norms. In other words, essentially it is the application of the secular tools of philosophy in order to explain aspects of the Jewish tradition. So on one hand, a Jewish philosopher, of course, at least one that is in the Jewish tradition, is bound by the authoritative teachings of Judaism, by the Torah, by the Talmud, by the Midrash, and all of that literature. But they attempt to explain them by the application of the categories that were developed in secular philosophy. Meaning to say that philosophical discourse is not an indigenous Jewish method of analysis. The Talmud, for example, is not a philosophical work in the way Aristotle wrote philosophy or Plato, but for a variety of historical reasons, it was felt that it was necessary for that period of time to explicate the Jewish tradition in terms of general philosophical concepts and norms. For example, Maimonides writes very specifically that the reason he wrote his great work, The Guide to the Perplexed, the Moreh Nevuchim, was because there were many, many Jews, particularly his own disciples, who were very involved in secular philosophy, and as a result they had questions regarding faith in God, the existence of God, why should we keep mitzvot, and the like. And Maimonides wanted to explain in their terms the legitimacy of the Torah and the like. Now that creates a certain problem, by the way, for the modern students of medieval Jewish philosophy. That is, medieval Jewish philosophy arose out of milieu of people that had certain types of questions. And it was an attempt to bridge the gap between their secular knowledge and their belief in the Torah by giving a rationalistic understanding of Torah in terms of general philosophical categories. It was a guide to the perplexed, very literally. Those who were perplexed, those who had questions of faith, those who could not reconcile a belief in God or a belief in revelation or a belief in the Torah with the logic of their philosophical studies needed some way to show that both are true. And we know, of course, that Maimonides had tremendous admiration for Aristotle. He writes in a number of times that Aristotle had reached the highest level a human being could reach, short of prophecy. He really had very unbounded admiration for Aristotle. And the Moreh Nevuchim is really an attempt to reconcile Greek philosophy, at least aspects of Greek philosophy, with the Jewish tradition. The problem the modern reader has is that, number one, much of us are unfamiliar with Greek philosophy, so we really don't know what are exactly the questions that are trying to be answered here. It's kind of, you know, is there a reason to give answers to questions that don't bother people today? And the truth of the matter is that unless one does have a philosophical grounding, much of the questions that medieval philosophers deal with are not necessarily things that tug at our heartstrings today. Now, that might be because we're a less intellectual generation. You know, they tell the story about a fellow who, in Minsk, he wanted to be a heretic. So he was told that if you want to be a heretic, you've got to go to Yassel. Yassel of Minsk is the apikoris, is the heretic of the community. So he asks around where this Yassel of Minsk is. So Yassel of Minsk is in a synagogue sitting over a Talmud learning. So he goes into the shul and he sees a man, a rabbi with a long white beard with a talus over his head and wearing his tefillin, and he's studying a Gemara, a big volume of Talmud. So he doesn't look like a heretic, but he goes over to him and says, "Are you Yassel? You're the apikoris of Minsk?" He says, "Yeah, I'm the apikoris." So he looks a little surprised. So yes, he said, "Well, I want to be an apikoris too. I was told I have to get your permission to join the club." So Yassel said, "Okay, certainly you know the Talmud." So he said, "Well, no, I haven't learned the Talmud because I'm an apikoris." He says, "Do you at least know the Bible? You know Chumash and Rashi's commentary?" He says, "No, I don't." So Yassel like waves his hand at him and says, "You're no apikoris, you're just ignorant." And, there is a concept that in order to be a heretic, as it were, one has to have a lot of knowledge. One has to know what you are rejecting. One knows the tradition, and one knows the philosophical arguments against the tradition, and one grapples with them, etc., and one tries to answer them, or sometimes doesn't have an answer, and that is the audience the Rambam is addressing. Most of us lack the knowledge in both the Jewish tradition and in particular the philosophical traditions to even be able to grasp with these. So consequently, what I'm going to be emphasizing in this book is I'm not going to be spending a lot of time, we'll be doing a little bit because we have to do a little bit, on things like how do we know there's a God and how do we know God is one, maybe God is two. We'll talk about that a little bit because those were primary philosophical issues for the Middle Ages. But I would prefer to emphasize issues that are much more indigenously Jewish, such as the role of prayer, the role of prophecy, the role of free will. So I'm going to de-emphasize the metaphysical and emphasize much more those aspects of Jewish philosophy that pertain to how we live our lives and kind of the behavioral aspects of how we relate to God, right? So we'll do a little bit of everything, but it's going to be backloaded towards the other, towards the second group of issues in Maimonides' principles. Yeah?
So, you mentioned earlier that in the Talmud they do not use the philosophical approaches.
Very rarely, yeah.
The Rambam says that Avraham Avinu used to use the methods of Socrates.
Yeah.
So he seems to be of the perspective that it was innate to the Jewish culture to use.
Well, you know, again, the fact that the Rambam indicates that, which doesn't really have a source anywhere, but the fact that the Rambam indicates that simply might mean that just as when the Rambam wrote the Mora Nevuchim, the Rambam had to address the questions that people had in order to bring them to the way of God, so the Rambam is teaching us that Avraham Avinu adapted the same tactic. Now, that does not mean, in other words, that is necessarily a Jewish way of viewing things. It does mean that Avraham Avinu was able to speak to people on the particular level that they were in order to bring them towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The fact that, for example, the Talmud and the Medrash generally do not speak in the philosophical language indicates that in terms of the what we call the Mesorah, the tradition of the Jew, that's not necessarily the way we view things. But we have to be able to deal with those issues because that's the way other people view things. Now, we do have in the Talmud, by the way, a number of discussions that are recorded between the sages of Jerusalem and the sages of Athens. There are a few passages, not very many, and the sages of Athens presumably would be many of the philosophical schools. But we have to keep in mind just the historical element here. If you go back to, Aristotle, you know, Aristotle was the tutor of Alexander the Great. Just shows you that when you have money, you know, you can get the best education. I mean, Philip of Macedonia was able to hire the most learned person in the world, basically, to be the private teacher of his son. Now, Alexander the Great lived several hundred years before the destruction of the Second Temple. So keep in mind that by the time we have already the Mishnah and the Talmud, that is way after the great period of Greek philosophers. So really, the Greek philosophers are a much, much earlier period than the Mishnah and the Talmud itself. Aristotle is really, towards the tail end of that particular golden age. Okay, so let me just mention today, I just want to mention kind of a few names just to give people a sense of, you know, who we're talking about and the like. The Jewish philosophical tradition, in terms of an organized body of literature, did begin in the Islamic Arabic cultures of North Africa, Spain, Egypt, etc. It later shifted to Christian France, but in the first part of it was in the Islamic cultures. Many of the early works were written in Arabic. In fact, the Moran Ibrahim itself was written in Arabic. The first well-known, it's not the very first, but the very first well-known work on Jewish philosophy that we have from that period is the work of Rav Sadia Gaon. And Rav Sadia Gaon lived, the dates we have are 882 to 942. And he was first in Egypt and then eventually in Babylon, which is Iraq. And his book is called Emunot V'Deot, which means beliefs and opinions and views. And he deals with such issues as creation of the world, unity of God, resurrection of the dead, recurring themes that are repeated over and over again, but he was the first to deal with them in a very systematic, organized treatise. And this was a work that was written in Arabic rather. And we know that during Rav Sadia Gaon's lifetime, there were major controversies with the Karaites. Now, the Karaites were a movement, Karaim, which denied the validity and authenticity of the oral Torah, particularly the Talmud. They were called Karaites because that basically means they only accepted a literal reading of the Bible. And Rav Sadia Gaon, in addition to general philosophical ideas, spends much of his work defending the authenticity and the historical validity of what is the oral law that became recorded in the Mishnah and the Talmud, because he was engaged extensively in anti-Karaite polemics. This was one of his very, very important tasks. Interestingly enough, you know, we always say the Karaites, which are really the successors to the Sadducees of the Second Temple period. They're not a successor in terms of any direct connection, but philosophically, they have much of the same agenda. But the truth of the matter is, if you think about it, the Sadducees and later the Karaites took the position, we only accept the written Torah, we don't accept the oral Torah. But of course, that's really an impossibility, because obviously any written texts eventually needs to be interpreted by some type of oral understanding. Even the meaning of language can only be understood by an oral tradition. How do we know that the word shoe means something you put on your foot? You know, your mother told you that. You know, there is kind of an oral tradition as to the very meaning of language. So when the Karaim take the position, we don't accept the oral traditions, we only accept the literal wording of the Torah, what happened was the Karaites developed their own oral interpretations of what the written text was. So it's not really a question, oh, you accept an oral tradition and I only go by the written. Rather, I don't accept your oral tradition. Eventually, I develop my own. So it was fascinating. I remember when I was in the Harvard Library, Widener Library, which has, by the way, a wonderful, wonderful collection of Svarim. It's really like the, I think after the Library of Congress, it's the largest. It's interesting that the top two Jewish libraries in the world are not even Jewish libraries, Library of Congress and Harvard's Widener Library. But I came across a Karaite Sidur. Now, much of our Sidur represents the creative works of the rabbis of the Talmud, or earlier, for example, the Amidah. Right? The Amidah is not in the Torah. The Amidah was composed later. So in a Karaite Sidur, as you would expect, there is no Amidah, there is no Shema Ne'esrei, right? They do recite the Shema, the paragraphs of the Shema, because that is in the Torah. But in lieu of the blessings before and after the Shema, which are rabbinic compositions, they have their own compositions. So they have a whole Sidur of prayers, which were composed by their own rabbis, not based on the text of the Torah, but based on their own oral tradition. So it's interesting that the Karaites, who supposedly rebelled against the authenticity of an oral tradition, eventually simply created a one of their own. And we will find, kind of as a political matter, that much of, or not at least a significant part of the discussions in Sadia Gaon, in Moreh Nevuchim, in the Kuzari, are all focused on kind of anti-Karaite polemics. What is interesting, though, again, just to digress for a second, is that the Karaites actually did become very, very good biblical scholars, as you would expect, because the Bible, in fact, as you know, the history of Jewish scholarship sometimes resulted in a de-emphasis of the Bible in favor of the Talmud. The Karaites were very, very acute biblical scholars, and the Ibn Ezra actually quotes the Karaites for interpretations of words, and the Karaites also engaged in anti-Christian polemic, kind of, because when various Christian missionaries would quote biblical verses from Isaiah, as they do today, to make their case for that, you know, Jesus was a Mashiach or whatever it would be, the Karaites, by their very, very close and good knowledge of a biblical text, were often able to refute. So one of the well-known anti-Christian works of the late Middle Ages, called Faith Strengthened, Chizuk Emunah, which is actually a book available in translation, was written by Rav Yitzchak Troki, the Karaite. So actually it's a work that is actually used even today to refute missionary claims, but it was actually a Karaite work. But that's Rav Sadia Gaon. Another person, oh yeah, I'm sorry. Yes. Yes.
And
that's correct, absolutely.
But was there any interest on the part of Jews living in
Babylon
in those philosophies?
Is
he also responding to that, or is it the way
the Karaites? Oh, no. Karaites were one thing he was responding to. It was not, I would not even say that that was his primary motivation. His primary motivation was that Jews who were living in a relatively open culture, at least philosophically speaking, were being exposed to many, many ideas which could have anti-traditional implications. And therefore there was a need to kind of set the record straight. Rav Sadia Gaon, even politically, had a very authoritative office. The Gaonet, he was the head of the academy. In those days, till around, in fact he was towards the tail end of it, till around the 11th century, there was kind of a world academy in Sura, in Babylon, which really set the direction and tenor for the entire Jewish world. They were the authoritative world body for Jewry. Rav Sadia Gaon was the head of the Academy of Sura, and for example, he was very instrumental in standardizing the Siddur, giving an official text for the prayer book, etc. And one of his goals was to standardize what the official Jewish belief would be. So, Karaites were one of his issues, but certainly he was responding to Jews being exposed to these various ideas. A next person that we're not going to be looking a lot about, but I just want to mention him so, because you know him from another context, was Rav Shlomo Ibn Gabaral. He lived in Spain in 1020 to 1057. So he died a relatively young man, 37 years old. And you may know Rav Shlomo Ibn Gabaral as the author of one of the most popular songs in the Jewish liturgy, and that is Adon Olam, the song that we give to our children to sing. Adon Olam, Master of the World, Asher Malach, Leterem Kol Yitzir Nivra, who ruled before there were any creatures. Almost all synagogues say it in Shabbat, and in a Sidur it is actually recited every day at the beginning of prayers. He was the author of Adon Olam. Adon Olam itself, by the way, is a very, very profound song that expresses the faith of God even at the moment of death and the leaving of the soul. But what is often not known is Rav Shlomo Ibn Gabaral was one of the most profound philosophers of the Middle Ages. He was a great mystic as well. And in fact, many of his works had a great influence even on Christian mysticism. He was considered to be very, very eminent, very, very great in his generation, but his works are extremely obscure and difficult to follow, but one should be aware at least of the name. The third name we're going to be reading a lot of, particularly in the Zirach, and that is Rab Bachya Ibn Pakuda. Some people pronounce the first name Bachaye, some say Bachya. Okay, it seems the right pronunciation seems to be Bachya. Rav Bachya Ibn Pakuda, the end of the 11th century in Spain. He is the author of a very, very great work that is called Chovot HaLevavot, which is translated in English as Duties of the Hearts. And let me describe that little book a little bit. Again, he's a product of Islamic Spain. And in his introduction, which you have in your Xerox, he differentiates between what are called chovot ha'evarim, which means duties of the limbs, which are the externals of the commandments, the things you gotta do, and the chovot ha'levavot, duties of the heart, that refer to the emotional state that a person must cultivate in their service of God. And this is one of the great classic works which emphasizes the internal aspect of serving God. That serving God is not a matter merely of repetitive action, but it's a matter of feeling and emotion and forethought and thinking. And in particular, the Chovot HaLevavot, which we might call, it's really, this straddles the line between philosophy and ethics. And I think it's very important, because what this tells us is the following. Ultimately, Judaism is not going to be happy with pure philosophy. Because, you know, as somebody once said, you can debate a long time whether the table is really a table or whether I just perceive it as a table, and we could talk about this a very long time, but the question then becomes, how does this make me a better person? How does this make me closer to God? How does this make me be a better parent or a better spouse? Right? So, consequently, you constantly find that although Judaism does address philosophical questions, it eventually moves away from them to make a bridge between philosophy and ethics. And the Chovot HaLevavot is one of the primary works that does this. It essentially takes philosophy and converts it into the realm of practical ethics. Now, by the way, it's very interesting. Even Aristotle, of course, wrote works on ethics, but it is my understanding that that was the only work that was not translated in Arabic, that was not available to the Islamic philosophers. In other words, they had the metaphysical works, the ethics were not available, and yet we find in the Jewish tradition, philosophy always leads to ethics. And the Chovot HaLevavot, you don't have the whole work here, so I'll just give you the areas that he deals with, is a work that is comprised in 10 chapters, which are called Sha'arim. Sha'arim are gates. So each chapter is called a gate. Gate number one, which is the most metaphysical and philosophical, is called Shar HaYichud, the gate of the unity of God, and that is an attempt to philosophically demonstrate that there's only one God and that God is not material, etc. And it's interesting, in the Jewish tradition, later, as we'll discuss, turned into kind of an anti-philosophical orientation, we will find that often you'll see this particular advice. The Chovot HaLevavot should be studied completely except for the Shar HaYichud. In other words, there was kind of a fear of confronting the metaphysical aspects of is there a God. But be it as it may, his first chapter is Shar HaYichud. The second chapter, which has been Xeroxed, is called Shar HaBechina. Shar HaBechina, Bechina of course means an examination, and this is a series of mental exercises in which one endeavors to see the goodness of God in every aspect of creation. So for example, you pick up an apple, and you would meditate on the apple or on the banana, and you would try to identify all of the different blessings that God has given us through these different opportunities. And we see Shar HaBechina is obviously very, very practical in terms of cultivating a consciousness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our own lives. The third gate, the third Shar, is Shar Avodat Elohim, the gateway of service of God, in which he details the imperatives of becoming a faithful servant of the divine. Again, we will go into this in more detail. I just want to get out some of the basic information. The fourth Shar is Shar HaBitachon, the gate of trust. And here he deals with a very important philosophical problem, but it's one that's practical as well. And that is, how do you balance trust in God with the need for human endeavor? Right? It's basically a simple question. If I believe that God determines how much I'm going to earn every year, then why do I have to go to work? Let me stay in bed. If it's coming to me, it'll be in my front door. And if it's not coming to me, going out and work is not going to help. Obviously, we know that there is a balance between the concept of reliance in God and the imperatives of what are called hishtadlut, of making my own efforts. And that balance, which, by the way, is kind of almost a commonplace. We all know that there's that balance, but the first real extended long discussion of the balance between faith and hishtadlut and human effort is in the Shar HaBitachon of the Chovot HaLevavot. So a lot of these, so you see, it's a philosophical question, But it's not a philosophical question like, you know, what is the nature of a table or whatever it is. It is a philosophical question that I have to confront every time I go into my car and I decide to go to work. Okay, so that's the idea of the practical orientation of the philosophical idea.
Did you say that the first chapter, Shar HaYichud, but that chapter is not currently accepted among a certain group of rabbis?
Well, I don't want to say that it's been censored. In any Chovat HaLevavot that you'll get, there will be chapter one. It's called Shar HaYichud, and so it's there. Nobody ripped it out. However, you will find in many circles, not universally, in many circles, they will discourage people from actively studying the Shar HaYichud, because they basically say that if you don't have problems, if you believe in God, why should you expose yourself to the various arguments against the existence of God and then read the answers? Sometimes it's better, it's kind of let sleeping dogs lie. And what we will see, was generally a certain attitude that took place in the Middle Ages itself, we will see, and I'll discuss this a little bit, in which there was a whole rebellion against the philosophical genre because it was creating questions for people who may not have had the questions to begin with. So you'll actually find that Chovat HaLevavot, people will say, everything's good except Shar HaYichud. By the way, just to give you an example of the credentials of one of the people that said that, it was no one less than the Vilna Gaon himself discouraged people from studying the Shar HaYichud. But again, it really kind of depends on a person's background. Yeah?
Was he writing original creative work, or was he writing down the Masorah, which he learned from someone?
Well, the Chovat HaLevavot quotes many, many sources. He quotes many passages from the Gemara, obviously much of Tanakh, he quotes many, many Midrashim, etc. But like anyone else, like any great Gadol, he's taking these sources, which are, of course, handed down, but he is then articulating his understanding of them. This is his understanding of what these sources are. By the way, the esteem in which the Chovat HaLevavot was held, this is before the Rambam, is the Rambam writes, and the Rambam was not that appreciative of his predecessor's Sfarim. The Rambam often mocked the people who were right before him. He said they didn't get it right, they didn't do it right. I mean, the Rambam was fairly critical of, let's say, the people who listed the mitzvot before him, etc. But he writes about the Chovat HaLevavot that this was such a beloved sefer that it never left his father's desk. He writes about his father, that his father constantly read the Chovat HaLevavot, which, by the way, was also written in Arabic and later translated in Hebrew. So the Shar Bitachon, again, is a classic chapter. That's one that, because it's so practical, we're going to be looking at. The fifth gate is Shar Yichud HaMa'aseh. Now, don't confuse this with Shar HaYichud. Shar HaYichud is the unity of God. Yichud HaMa'aseh really means the unity of your actions, and that refers to the need for sincerity in our service of God, meaning he develops the idea, again, based on earlier sources, that one does not serve Hashem in order to get reward or in order to for people to appreciate you or admire you. One should cultivate the trait of sincerity and integrity in their service of God. Wholeheartedness. That is Yichud HaMa'aseh. And what he does in all of these chapters is, he not only lays out the doctrine, lays out the idea, but he also has like practical exercises that one can incorporate in how to inculcate this idea. Okay, it's not just, here's the idea, but like, what do you think about? What do you do? What can you do? And by the way, one of the interesting things is, he quotes extensively from non-Jewish sources, in particular, a group of Arabic philosophers that were known as the Sufi mystics. Again, this is based on an idea that the Rambam also brings, Kabel et ha'emet misha amro. One is allowed to accept, one should accept the truth from whatever source. So although it is quintessentially a Jewish book that is rooted in the literature of the Torah and rabbinic literature, but when he does see valuable insights from other religious traditions, that do not contradict and that are consistent with the teachings of the Torah, he's willing to incorporate them as the Rambam did as well. That, of course, creates always problems that we face today. For example, people often go back earlier than this. Besides the Rambam, the Chovat HaLevavot, they go back to the Talmud itself. Right? The Talmud discusses there was one great rabbi of the Talmud who became a heretic, became a non-believer, and this was Elisha ben Avuya, who is known in the Talmud as Acher, the other one. We don't even like to say his name. In fact, Milton Steinberg even wrote a novel as a driven leaf about the torments of Elisha ben Avuya. And he was a great Torah scholar. He had a great knowledge of Torah. And it says that the great Rabbi Meir used to continue to follow Elisha ben Avuya around to learn Torah from him, even when Elisha ben Avuya was a non-believer who was not practicing the commandments. And the Talmud gives us a story that he was once, Elisha ben Avuya was riding a horse on Yom Kippur that fell on Shabbos, and he was eating on Yom Kippur, and Rav Meir was following him, asking him all sorts of questions in halacha. And Elisha ben Avuya was answering him. And in fact, you know that in Shabbat, if you're not supposed to go more than 2,000 cubits from the edge of a city. The city keeps on keeping in his houses, it's not a problem. But, you know, so Elisha ben Avuya told Rabbi Meir, as he was riding on his horse on Yom Kippur, you got to stop here, you're not allowed to go any further. Like, he was still sensitive to Rav Meir's beliefs. So Rav Meir begged him, repent, do tshuva, you're so great. And he said, I can't do tshuva. For whatever reason, he felt that he could not do tshuva. But the Gemara recounts that the sages were critical of Rabbi Meir for learning Torah from the heretic, because the heretic could give you all sorts of things that are wrong and undermine your faith in God. And Rabbi Meir gave the famous parable that he is like a pomegranate, where you peel off the peel, the inedible peel, and you eat the good seeds, or the opposite. It's like a fruit that has a pit. You discard the pit and you eat the fruits. And he says, I can take the good and discard the bad. So this is sometimes a contemporary issue. You know, should one learn? You know, there are many people in the world and they have tremendous Jewish scholarship in various areas, but they may have fundamental beliefs that are inconsistent with the Torah. So sometimes the serious Jewish religious students may wonder, gee, is it proper for me to study Torah from someone that doesn't have you know, beliefs in God or whatever? And often people cite the Acher story to say, you know, take the good and separate the bad. But, you know, the standard answer that we give is that when one reaches the level of Rabbi Meir, then one can learn Torah from the Acher. One is not the level of Rabbi Meir, one has to avoid it. So the fact is, the fact that the Chovat HaLevavot and the Rambam were willing and able to look at all sorts of sources to derive fundamental truths isn't necessarily a safe exercise for all of us, but nevertheless there is a precedent there. So that's Yichud HaMaaseh, the notion of wholeheartedness and sincerity. Then the next gate is Hachna'ah, Shar Hachna'ah. Hachna'ah is humility in the presence of God. And here is the famous discussion between legitimate pride and illegitimate pride. And again, difficult balance here, because the point is this. All of these things are difficult. It's good to talk about being humble, but if a person goes through their life thinking that they're worthless, insignificant, and trash, then they will never have the impetus within their soul to achieve spiritual greatness. A person needs, we know this as teachers, that, you know, self-esteem and the like, that one of the most important gifts that one can give a child or a student is a sense of their importance, a sense of their greatness, a sense of their ability to accomplish. Once again, we have a balancing problem. One must be humble in the presence of God. One must be aware of their weaknesses. One must be aware of their insignificance. And yet one must also be aware of their greatness. Many, many years later, Chovat HaLevavot devotes many pages to this in the Shar Hachna'ah. But to give you an example of how later the Hasidic movement took much of these teachings and made them epigrammatic, turned them into an epigram, we have in the 19th century the famous epigram of Rav Bunim of Peshitsa that basically said, I'm sure all of you have heard this, that a person must have two ideas in their pockets at all times. One of them is Bishvili Nivra HaOlam, because of me the world was created. God created the world for one human being. Each one of us justifies this universe. And in the other pocket, you have to know, Anochi Afar V'Efer, I am dust and ashes. Right? So that's a very pithy way of summarizing the idea of knowing our limitations, being humble, not being arrogant, but recognizing our greatness and our potential to become great and do great and wonderful things. Well, the Chovat HaLevavot deals with it in a more philosophical and lengthy treatment. That's Hachna'ah. The next gate, which I think I will assign for next week because it's so fortuitous between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, is the Shar HaTshuvah, the gate of repentance. And he deals with the fundamental issue of how can a person undo the past. Right? You can't undo spilled milk. And yet the gift of repentance says that whatever we have done in the past, we have the capacity of changing it, we have the capacity of being forgiven, we have the capacity of not being limited by what we are. What we are is not a function of what we were. We can go beyond it. This is, of course, the season for Tshuva, so although it's a little out of order, I think I will ask you to read for next week, we'll discuss this, the treatise called the Treatise on Repentance, or the Gate of Repentance, that you have in your Xerox materials. Okay, so although I wanted to save the ethical stuff for towards the end, but I think it might be worthwhile to look at this now. And the last three gates I'll mention very quickly. Shar Cheshbon HaNefesh, the gate of spiritual accounting, which is really a subdivision of Tshuva, but he wrote it out as a separate gate. Cheshbon HaNefesh is the sense of being aware of how we live our lives and to kind of go over our lives. You know, the truth of the matter is, people say, if we would put the effort in our life plan that we put in our business plan, we would all be much more successful human beings. A person, when you have a business, you examine the balance sheets, you examine the past, you have a strategic plan for the future, you have a sense of goals, at least if it's a well-managed business. Where do you want to be in a year from now? Where do you want to be in 2 years? Long-term goals, short-term goals. There's constant evaluation. Am I meeting my goals? Am I off track? Should I redefine my goals? Because they're either counterproductive or not attainable, right? All of that is what is cheshbon hanefesh, to make an accounting. Ideally, one should do this literally every day, but at least, you know, some people do it every month, certainly once a year, at the very minimum. But that is the notion of cheshbon hanefesh. The ninth gate, again, deals with a controversial issue in Jewish religion, that is shar haprishut, the gate of separation, or abstinence is the better word, abstinence. And this deals with the following issue. Again, a very practical issue, although it's a philosophical issue. And that is it good to be abstinent from physical pleasures? Or is it bad to be abstinent from physical pleasures? Now I know that most of us have heard the idea that unlike some religious traditions, which are ascetic, they seek denial of the physical. Even classical Christianity says a holy person does not get married. A holy person takes a vow of chastity, a vow of poverty. Right? It's a concession for the lower folk. But, you know, the sacramental people who are truly devoted separate from the world. But on the other hand, there's certainly a thought that in Judaism, God does not want us to reject the world. God wants us, within reason and within balance, to enjoy the world. With a sense of using it for God's service. The classical text that is often cited is the Nazarite, the person who takes a vow not to drink wine. Right? So the Torah says that the Nazarite must bring a sacrifice at the end of his period of that vow because he has sinned. Rashi brings a passage of the Talmud that says that the reason the Nazarite has sinned is because he has deprived himself of the legitimate pleasures of the Torah. The Torah says you're allowed to drink wine. So if you put yourself up as more righteous than the Torah, denying yourself legitimate pleasures, that's considered to be a form of sin. There's a passage in the Jerusalem Talmud that says, and don't tell your kids this because they can use it against you, that says, after 120 years, every person will be held to account for every legitimate pleasure they could have enjoyed that they didn't enjoy. Right, the roller coaster, whatever it is, you know, something like. Or Rav Hirsch used to say, Rav Hirsch lived in 19th century Germany. He says that God is going to ask, because he was talking to people who lived there, God is going to ask each and every one of us, why didn't we enjoy the Swiss Alps? He put them there for us to enjoy. So on one level, we have this concept that Judaism says, enjoy the world. Don't make it, don't be obsessed with materialism, but enjoy it. On the other hand, we also find in rabbinic teachings many, many warnings that the more that one is involved in material acquisition, the more there is a tendency to arrogance, there is a tendency to forgetting God, there's a tendency to having one's spiritual sensitivities blunted as you're into possessions and everything else. The Torah itself talks about Vayishman Yeshurun Vayivatz, that when the Jewish people get fat and prosperous, that is when they reject God, much more so than when there's poverty and adversity. So once again, we have this balance here. We have some teachings that kind of say, disengage yourself from this world and focus only on the Torah and the mitzvot. We have other teachings that say one should enjoy, right? So this is the difficult, again, the practical but philosophical issue in the Shar HaPrishut. To what degree do we separate? To what degree do we enjoy, etc. By the way, just to give you an example of how authoritative texts can be interpreted by the great rabbis in totally opposite ways, I mentioned Rashi's interpretation, which is from the Gemara actually, that the Nazir is the sinner because he became a Nazir and he abstained from wine, which is a legitimate pleasure in the Torah, and God says that's sinful because I want you to enjoy legitimate pleasure. That's what Rashi says. Of course, I should say Rashi happened to own a vineyard. Okay, but that's not. But Rashi quoted it from the Talmud. But Rashi did not, God forbid, make this up. Now, Nachmanides says exactly that. No, Nachmanides and Ramban writes, the Nazir is a sinner not because he became a Nazir, but because he's leaving. After he's reached the exalted level of abstinence from the material, how dare he... truly have fear of God, we would be very well behaved, but it is inferior to the notion of serving God because one's heart is filled with love of God. And the Shar Avat Hashem discusses the strategies and the mindsets and the meditations that can bring a person to a love of God. So it's a very, very wonderful work, and I've picked three gates that we'll be looking at out of the ten. And what's wonderful about it is that it does take philosophy from the realm of the theoretical and it puts it into the practical. So it is a philosophical work. It very much is in the philosophical tradition as opposed to the later ethical works. But it does so with always an emphasis on how do we cultivate those inner virtues that bring us closer to God. By the way, even the concept of serving God out of fear is not a simple thing because there are many, many levels of fear. There is what is called the lower fear, and there is what is called the higher fear. The lower fear is simply the concept of reward and punishment that says, I'll keep a commandment because God will punish me if I don't, either in this world or the world to come, whatever it is. But there's another type of fear, which is not really fear of punishment, but it's a sense of reverence, awe, and respect. So, for example, one might say, I'm fearful to do something in the presence of the Queen of England, or the President of the United States. Not because, you know, they'll do something to me. I mean, probably, you know, if I would, spit in front of the President, they're not going to kill me, you know, at least in the United States. In some countries they might, but, you know, they're not going to kill me here, whatever it is. But there's a concept of a certain respect and reverence, if not for the person, at least for the office. And therefore, when one has that respect and that reverence, one does not behave in certain ways. So that's not the same as the lower fear. That's a much higher level of fear. And that's a fear that is called, the language that uses, Yirat HaRomamot, fear of God's awe. So there's Yirat HaOnesh, fear of punishment. Yirat HaRomamot is fear and reverence of awe. Yes, yes. There is a third level of fear. So the bottom one is Yirat HaOnesh, fear of punishment. The second one is Yirat HaRomamot, that is awe and reverence for the divine presence. Kind of the way you would do it. Qualitatively different, but somewhat similar to the way one would fear a king or a prince. But then there is a kind of a fear, which is not as you pointed out, a fear that the sin will destroy what I am, what it will do to me. Now, that is a fear, though, that is actually connected to love of God. That's interesting. That's kind of a fear that comes after love. In other words, there is these two levels of fears that lead eventually to love. But love leads to a fear of its own. And that is, when one loves God with all their hearts, one is so afraid of losing that connection with God because it's so painful, it hurts so much. And that is called the fear of sin, which is a fear that one will lose that loving connection to God. So you're correct, that is a form of fear, but that is a fear that is connected to the notion of love. Right? So that's the Chovat HaLevavot.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
That would be the highest.
And that's the highest. That is a fear that comes after love. Yes.
And that's
That's called Yirat Chet. That fear of sin. The fear of sin is a very high level. That's the fear that comes of not wanting to sever my connection to God. Okay, so, again, the truth is, although this was a pretty long digression for the Chovat HaLevavot, but as I mentioned, I'm just giving you names right now. Chovat HaLevavot is a long, long name. Now, the next name I just want you to be aware of is also a very, very famous person in many, many areas, and who lived right after Bachya ibn Pakuda, and this was Avraham ibn Ezra. Famous Ibn Ezra. His dates are 1099 to 1164. And the Ibn Ezra, of course, was famous in many, many areas. His great fame is as a biblical commentator. He wrote books on, commentaries on most of the books of the Bible. He was one of the great grammarians, his understanding of the Hebrew language. He was also a philosopher and a poet. He was older than Maimonides of the Rambam, but he did know the Rambam. In fact, the Rambam in his lifetime was more famous than the Ibn Ezra. So the Ibn Ezra wanted to meet the Rambam once, and he couldn't meet the Rambam. The one time he was able to see, he wasn't able to meet the Rambam in person. So the Ibn Ezra wrote a long poem lamenting the fact that he never had a chance to meet the Rambam. He kind of complained a little bit. He said, you know, if I would become an undertaker, you know, God would revive the dead. When I become a candle maker, God will bring eternal light. He says, it may be good for the world, but I'm always excluded from it. And you know, part of his poetic style also was he wrote a lot of riddles. In fact, he liked riddles. And even in the introduction to his commentary in the Torah, he throws in a riddle, and then you know, very obscure riddle. And commentaries in the 19th century try to they give like a page interpretation. Oh, this is what the Ibn Ezra means with his riddle and the like. But the Ibn Ezra was also a great philosopher. As a philosopher in the Jewish tradition, he is somewhat controversial. And the reason he is somewhat controversial, we don't have any excerpts from him, is that in the realm of philosophy, there are statements in his works that do depart from the traditional teachings of the Talmud and the Medrash. In other words, rather than incorporate those teachings in his philosophical structure, he kind of took the position sometimes that although in halakha we must follow the received tradition, he felt he was very free in matters of theology to espouse some different ideas. And as a result, that became very, very controversial. But nevertheless, that is a reality. He was very severely criticized for that by people like the Ramban, Nachmanides, for that type of deviation. But nevertheless, that was his position. That was a position that you will find occasionally among a number of Jewish philosophers. The next person, which is still, well, it's concurrent with the Ibn Ezra, but it's still pre-Maimonides, is Yehuda HaLevi. And that's, actually, he's older, yeah, that's 1075 to 1141. And here, Yehuda HaLevi was known again for many, many things. He lived in Spain for most of his life. Yehuda HaLevi is considered to be the greatest poets of the Jewish people. He wrote both religious poetry, and he also wrote secular poetry. A little bit surprising that he did write matters of secular poetry as well. Some of his works as a poet are recited on the 9th of Av. There's a whole series on the keynote, the Lamentations, that we recite on the 9th of Av. Towards the end of the Lamentations, there are poems that are called the Zionites, poems of Tzion, and he is the author of many of those poems. The most well-known of them is Tzion, Halo Tishali, L'Shlom Asirayich. It's also a song, I won't sing it for you, but in which he turns to Zion and he says, turns to Israel, and he says, Tzion, will you not inquire after the peace of your prisoners, those who are waiting for you, those who are pining for you? And he talks about, if only I could be a bird and fly over, if only I could do any mitzvah. Like, he yearns and he pines, Libi b'Mizrach, my heart is in the east, even though I am in the west. Right? Many of these verses came from Yehuda HaLevi.
Is this the Keli Tzion? Is that what you're referring to? That the which is very strongly sung at the end of the
but he did not write that one. But a little before that, Tzion Halo Tishali L'Shlom Asirayich.
Because when you mentioned singing, that's the most famous.
Yes,
that,
well, his one. No, no. There's a nigga that's on a Jewish record. We don't on Tisha B'Av, we don't sing that one. Keli Tzion. It's not. It's Eli Tzion. Eli means to cry. Elitzion is Russian of crying, but we don't, that's not your view now, but shortly before, about 10 pages before that, there are a number of poems that he wrote. There is a legend that says that towards the end of his life, he finally came to the land of Israel. Of course, it was a very, very dangerous trip there, and the legend says that he was killed by an Arab on horseback as he was at the gates of Yerushalayim. He was killed right outside of Yerushalayim, or trampled to death as he was there. It's not clear if that's entirely true, but he was a great, great lover of Eretz Yisrael. In addition, we have some Zemirot and Shabbat that are authored by Rav Yehuda HaLevi. Yom Shabbaton Ein Lishkoach, Yonah Matzah B'Manoach, the Dove found a rest in Shabbat, is written by Yehuda HaLevi. And we know that because the verses spell out, the first letter of the acrostics spell out Yehuda. That is from Yehuda HaLevi. There are other various other songs, songs as well. But in addition to his greatness as a poet, he did write one of the most important works of Jewish medieval philosophy, and that is the Kuzari. The Kuzari is based on a story, which largely is true. And that, in terms of the poetry, I'll tell you that he actually wrote 350 different prayers. Only a tiny fraction of which are included in our liturgy, but there are many, many prayers that he had. The Kuzari involves a story of a kingdom in southeastern Russia, around the Black Sea, on the Caspian Sea, of the Khazars. And this was a group of people that converted to Judaism. They were actually a kingdom, an autonomous kingdom, that became Jewish. And the legend of how they became Jewish was that the king had a dream that God had appeared to him. And God said, your kavanot, your intentions are good, but your actions are not good. You must investigate the true religion. And the story goes that the Khazar, king of Khazaria, called the proverbial rabbi, minister, priest, whatever, that's the Islam, Christian, Jew, and discussed a long time, etc., and was eventually convinced that Judaism was the true religion, and converted. Now, for many, many years, it was thought that this was a made-up story. Yehuda HaLevi just made up this this story as kind of a dramatic basis for his book, but it is now pretty well established that there actually was this historical event. There actually was this conversion. However, what Rav Yehuda HaLevi does is, he uses this story. Now, Rav Yehuda HaLevi was not the rabbi. Rav Yehuda HaLevi was not the person who was involved. This occurred hundreds of years before him. But he uses this story to create a dialogue, a reconstructed dialogue between the kings of the Khazars and the rabbi, who is called the Chaver, in which they debate by question and answer various phenomena of Jewish theology. Now, Rav Yehuda HaLevi actually writes as if this was some long-lost manuscript that he discovered. In other words, Yehuda Halevi doesn't even claim to have authored this book. Yehuda Halevi says, this is what was found as a rabbi discussed with the king of the Khazar as to what the Judaism is about. But by and large, it is actually said that this was kind of his dramatic structure. He wrote the book anonymously out of his modesty, but in fact, he didn't just discover some long-lost manuscript, but he is considered to be the author of the Khuzari. Anybody want to show you how it is? For example, if you look here, the cover says, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Now, you may be confused, because if you ever look at a Hebrew Khuzari, they actually have the Hebrew one in the back, it'll say something like, gives a different name. Okay, he doesn't have it here. He just said, you know, but it'll say, Sefer HaKuzari L'Rav Yitzchak HaSardi. But that's kind of a made-up name of the imaginary rabbi who was said to have converted the Khazarian nation. That's why we'll see a different name in the Hebrew. It'll say, found by Rav Yehuda Halevi. But it comes to that this was his particular book. Now, Rav Yehuda Halevi has what is sometimes called it's a pejorative way of saying it, but an anti-rationalist bias, meaning to say that although he does incorporate much Greek philosophy, he's also very disparaging of that tradition, and he does not carry with it the same admiration for the postulist of Aristotelianism as the Rambam does. So the Khuzari is kind of a spirited defense of the Torah and the Jewish faith without having to reconcile it to every particular teaching of the philosophical tradition. Okay, so as I say, we will be looking at extensive excerpts from the Khuzari, both in Rabbi Black's book and in that newer translation. Okay, so we've looked at just in terms of names, Sadia Gaon, Shlomo ibn Gabaral, Bachya ibn Pakuda, Avraham ibn Ezra, Yehuda Halevi of Castile, of Spain. And then, of course, we get to the greatest, most monumental figure of Jewish medieval philosophy, who we will not be concentrating on that much, and that is none other than Rav Moshe ben Maimon, the Rambam, Maimonides, 1135 to 1204. In fact, Maimonides was held in such esteem by all the generations that we even know exactly his time of birth and death, which is very rare. And I don't remember the time, but like, you know, 1135 in the morning, they've even recorded exactly when he was born, and exactly when, which I think is the only figure in Jewish history that we have, you know, the exact time. Right. That's right. Now you'll notice, though, just looking at the dates, if the Rambam was born in 1135, you can see that his life did overlap with the Ibn Ezra, who didn't die until 1164, and it overlapped very slightly with Yehuda Halevi, who died in 1141. Right. So Yehuda Halevi was what, 6 years old when the Rambam died.
Rambam was 6 years old.
The Rambam was 6 years old. When he died, yes, I'm sorry. Yeah. Now, the Rambam, as you know, had a very varied life. Born in Spain, of course, he was at the height of the Almohad persecutions, and as a result, he and his family fled to many, many places to escape. For a while, they even went to Israel, but they did not stay there very long. Eventually, the Rambam did settle in Egypt. He did become the Sultan's chief physician. It's interesting, you know, it's amazing. The Rambam writes about how difficult his schedule was. He talked about he was working a full day as a doctor. He didn't come home till late at night. When he came home late at night, there were lines of people waiting to see him, both for medical advice and for halakha and different questions. And the Rambam had to say, push them off for half an hour because he hadn't eaten anything for 24 hours. He would have supper, and then he would have to lie in bed as people would come to him. He said he was so exhausted. And after he had seen all of these people, which he said sometimes was not finished until 2 hours into the after midnight, that is when he would do his writing. So the Rambam's works were all written not under the most optimal conditions. And we know, of course, that by the way, before the Rambam became a doctor, he actually made a living as a professor of Islamic philosophy, professor of Arabic philosophy at one of the Islamic universities. I mean, he was a college professor. He was not teaching Jewish philosophy, he was teaching general metaphysics and philosophy, but eventually he went into medicine. And we know that many, many works, but the two primary works of the Rambam are the Mishneh Torah, the repetition of the Torah, which is an attempt to summarize all of the halakha as derived from the Talmud and all of those sources in very concise, organized fashion. He called it Mishneh Torah because he believed you could read the written Torah and read his work, and that will give you a total knowledge of the oral law without going into all the debates and discussions of the Talmud. By the way, he was very much criticized for that, because some people criticized him that he was trying to undermine theoretical Talmudic study by giving people the bottom line instead of forcing them to grapple with all the debate, etc. The other name that the Rambam gave his work was Yad HaChazakah, the strong hand. That's interchangeable with Mishneh Torah, and that's a little bit of a pun. It's a double pun, because Yad, the numerical equivalent of Yad, is 14, and the Mishneh Torah has 14 books. And the other pun is that Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, is described at the end of the Torah as the mighty hand, Yad HaChazakah, that he did for all of Israel. And the Rambam, his name was Moshe, Yad HaChazakah, this was his mighty hand. This was his halachic work. Now, the Mishneh Torah itself is not a philosophical treatise. The Mishneh Torah itself is a legal book. It is a book of law. It is a book of telling us how to act. But the Rambam, as it were, could not stop himself from being engaged in philosophy. In fact, the Rambam writes that he had deep, deep love for philosophical speculation. So at various points in the Mishneh Torah, the Rambam does interject a number of philosophical discussions. In particular, the first book of the Mishneh Torah, which is called Sefer Hamada, the Book of Knowledge, when the Rambam talks about believing in God, because before he gets into law, he talks about belief in God, he does discuss in brief form the various notions of God, etc. However, the Rambam's second work, his major philosophical work, was not written in Hebrew, it was written in Arabic, and that's called Moreh Nevuchim, that's the Hebrew translation, Guide to the Perplexed. And this was originally written as a long letter to a disciple of his, Yosef ibn Aknin, who had much trouble reconciling Judaism with the philosophy that he was learning, and eventually it became a book. One must be aware that the Moreh Nevuchim, the Rambam was criticized in his lifetime for many, many things. Even the Mishneh Torah, which is a book of law, he was criticized for because it felt he was undermining the study of Talmud. But in particular, he was criticized tremendously for the Moreh Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, and the theological discussions in the beginning of Sefer Hamada, because it was felt that he was interjecting too much reliance on Greek philosophy and Aristotelianism, of which he had a great admiration, and was thus undermining the faith. As a result, we have a whole period, and much of this opposition, by the way, came from the Christian European countries. The Jews in France and Germany were very much opposed to the philosophical genre anyway, and we have a whole period, both during the Rambam's lifetime and to a lesser degree after the Rambam's lifetime, called the Maimonidean Controversy, in which some of the Rambam's works were excommunicated, they were banned, some of them were even burnt. Burnt, I don't mean by the non-Jews, by Jewish populations, particularly the Guide to the Perplexed and sections of the Sefer Hamada, the Book of Knowledge. And this was a very, very bitter controversy. It was not that long-lived, but it, for the 50 or 60 or 70 years, things were very, very difficult. Some of this controversy already erupted in the Rambam's lifetime. Some of the controversy erupted after the Rambam's death. Eventually, it was more or less resolved, but even though the animosity may have been resolved, still, among many, many segments of the Jewish people, there was still a long belief that the Moreh Nevuchim is not something one should... Similar to the Shar HaYichud of the Chovet HaLevavot, that there was indeed much discouragement of pursuing the Moreh Nevuchim and the like. Yeah?
How long
talking about children of the Rambam at the time when you had such a rigorous daily schedule of things.
Yes, the Rambam's schedule, as a physician who was working so many hours, the Rambam really started this in his 40s. And the reason this is so is the Rambam was not planning to do this. The Rambam had a brother, David. And David was a jewel merchant. And David, similar to the way we describe Yisachar and Zebulun, you've heard this rabbinic teaching, Yisachar devoted themselves to the study of the Torah, and Zebulun was engaged in commerce. And Zebulun was supporting Yisachar, right, the kind of partnership. So originally, the Rambam was being supported by his brother David so he could engage in full-time Torah study. His brother died at sea. His brother perished in a sea voyage. And the Rambam writes about what a tremendous tragedy this was in terms of his love for his brother, etc. But it also had the other side effect, that the Rambam had to get a paying job, kind of a modern problem. He literally had no economic supports at that particular point. And that happened when he was in his early 40s, and he really worked out of necessity. He had no one to support him at that particular time. But his original plan was, his brother had wanted to support him in his Torah learning. Okay, so be it as it may, one should be aware that the Mor Nevuchim is on one level considered to be the most authoritative work on Jewish philosophy, but it also perhaps is the most controversial because of the tremendous reliance and connection with Aristotelianism. The complexity of its arguments, the fact that the Rambam intimates, if for reasons we don't fully understand, that he wrote the work in the form of a code, meaning he said, if you are familiar with these problems, you will see all sorts of hints and intimations that I am hinting at that I'm not articulating. He specifically says he is not articulating the entire line of argument. It's a kind of a difficult work to follow. If any of you are interested, the Mor Nevuchim, the standard translation was by Michael Friedlander. That dates back to the 19th century. But in the 1970s, it was retranslated by Shlomo Pines, professor at the Hebrew University, which is a much, much superior translation. And as an introduction to the translation, there is an essay by Leo Strauss, who's a philosopher who's not alive anymore, who tries to show the esoteric secret nature of the Mor Nevuchim that the Rambam alludes to very often, that there really is, besides the external book, there is a structure within the book which contains a number of hidden philosophical messages. Yeah?
There are books written on the Mor Nevuchim by Fox.
Martin Fox wrote studies on it, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, as I say, Marvin Fox, you know, is an observant Jew. He's a professor actually he's not, I think he's alive anymore, but until he was lifted, he was certainly an observant person. But as I say, many people, it depends on one's inclination, one's tradition, one's religious beliefs here, but many people generally have tended to shy away. This is really a legacy from those controversies going back hundreds of years ago. And it goes back to the idea, we're going to see this constantly. On one hand, we have a huge philosophical literature, and on the other hand, we have a huge amount of people saying you're not supposed to look at this stuff, right? So you see there is a constant tension between what one might call the rationalistic exposition of Judaism and the notion of accepting Judaism as a matter of inner faith and conviction without having to prove it by logic. Because there is a feeling on one level that proving things by logic means one's faith is not perfect. The other level is, no, if you only accept it by faith and there's no logical basis for it, then you could be shown wrong without ever having any particular answer. So you're going to always see this push and pull going back and forth. It was the Shar HaYichud of the Chovat HaLevavot, the Mor Nevuchim of the Rambam, we will see later. Now, on the other hand, I do know there were great rabbis who made it a point to study the Mor Nevuchim in the period between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, because they felt it strengthened their faith by giving them the arguments for the existence of God. Now, let me just mention a few other names, and that is, let me mention a post-Maimonidean philosopher who also has either a comet or a planet named after him. This is Gersonides, Rav Levi ben Gershon. Ralbag, he's abbreviated. Rav Levi ben Gershon, 1288 to 1344, so he's already the next generation. He already lived in France and Christian Europe at this point. Rav Levi Ben Yeshom was quite a very interesting and also controversial character. Number one, people don't realize he had a very extraordinary lineage. He was the nephew of Ramban, Nachman, Nachman. He was the son of Ramban's sister. Although it's doubtful that Ramban and Ralbag agreed on very much. Ralbag wrote many commentaries on the Bible. In fact, a standard edition of the prophets, prophetic books with commentaries, will have the Ralbag's commentary. And commentaries are very accepted, very studied. One of the unique features of the Ralbag's commentary style is at the end of a narrative, he will summarize the ethical lessons one learns from a narrative. So he'll interpret it verse by verse by verse by verse, and at the end of the story, he'll give you 22 lessons or 30 lessons that you learn from it. And these are called To'aliyot HaRalbag. To'aliyot are the practical lessons of the Ralbag. Right? So those are fine, and people have no problem with the commentaries. The Ralbag was also an astronomer, great scientist, and as I mentioned, there are even a planet or a comet that is named after him. But the Ralbag, as a philosopher who wrote separate philosophical works, in particular, his primary work is called Milchemet Hashem, The Wars of God, or Milchemot Hashem, The Wars of God. His works are extremely controversial. Rabbi Bleich excerpts some of those works in terms of resurrection, not having to be literal, etc. He has various unusual views. Again, we'll wait until we cover them, but he has unusual views on such issues as the reconciliation of free will with God's omniscience, right? That's one of the most controversial theological conundrums, is God knows everything. God knows the future. God knows what I'm going to do tomorrow. And yet we posit I have absolute freedom to do it or not to do it, right? So that's a good problem. Ralbag offers unusual solutions for that. And we'll see that, once again, some of his views have not been assimilated into the mainstream. Yeah.
Those are the same thing as Mohammed Hashem and Dehu.
No, don't confuse that. That's correct. Actually, he took his uncle's title. You're correct. The Mohammed Hashem in the back of the Gemara is simply the Ramban's comments on the halachas of the Rif. That's just pure halacha. It's not a philosophical work. But the Ralbag has the same title. And the last name, I want to mention three more names, and then we'll break. So Ralbag is controversial. Then we have Chistoy Kreskes. Those are two names. Chistoy, that's how I'll spell it. That's C-H, or Chastoy, C-H-A-S-D-A-I. And he goes by the last name Kreskes, K-R, or C-I, that's also called C-R-E-S-C-A-S. Who died in 1412. Chistoy Kreskes is considered to be one of the greatest of the Jewish philosophers, but also among the most obscure. His works are very, very difficult to follow. His book is called Or Hashem, The Light of God. Very, very important work, but the importance of the work lies in its popularization, which is the next work I'll mention. Meaning to say, very hard to go back to Kreskes and read Kreskes, but Kreskes had a wonderful popularizer in which one can go back and read, and the great popularizer of Kreskes was a book that you have a lot of Xeroxing from and Rabbi Blachley produces, and that is Rav Yosef Alba. Rav Yosef Alba lived in Italy in the 15th century, and Rav Yosef Alba authored a book that is called Sefer HaIkarim, The Book of Fundamentals, a very, very clear, I won't say easy to read book, because obviously these books are difficult, but something that you can follow. It's not so obscure that it's difficult to follow, which is why I've done a lot of Xeroxing from that book in particular, much easier than the Kuzari or the Moreh Nevuchim. Now, although Alba does not always acknowledge it specifically, but Alba was a disciple of Chistoy Kreskes, and it is said that the basic impetus for the systemization and organization of Alba's philosophical system is based on the Or Hashem, the light of God. So one might say that Kreskes is, that Rav Alba is Kreskes light, in the reverent term. Although it's interesting that I just noticed, for various reasons, I'm not sure if there's a Kreskes revival here. I'm not sure. I just noticed that the Or Hashem was just reprinted in Hebrew only, with Hebrew vowels, after being out of print for almost half a century. So I'm not sure what the impetus for that was. But I see that, indeed, some of the Jewish philosophical books are being reprinted. Now, the Sefer HaYikarim does have, as you see from your Xerox, a very excellent translation. But it's been out of print for almost 30 or 40 years now. So you can only get it. The Life reproduces a lot of it, and it's by Isaac Husik, H-U-S-I-K, who also wrote a major book on the history of medieval Jewish philosophy. It's not alive anymore. But Sefer HaYikarim is a very, very useful book, although again, he doesn't create any original thoughts, but it's a good organization and systematization. So in terms of our course, the primary three books that we will be focusing on is we will be focusing on the Sefer HaYikarim, some sections of the Kuzari, and the Chovat HaLevavot, which is the philosophy turned into ethics. Those will be the three major ones that will be we'll be looking at. So what time do you have on the tour today? What time? We're supposed to go to 11:30?
Yeah.
Okay, so let me go a little on. So this is really just very, very introductory, just to give people a sense of names, who these names are, and you can see that we roughly are covering, I mentioned 600 to 1500, but with Sadia Gaon is a little later than that, we've covered, 800 to around the 1500s. Now, let me mention already the beginnings of the decline of this type of philosophical tradition. And there's one other figure I want to mention in that connection. And that is, in the late 15th century, the late 1400s, we have a very great man in Spain, which is now Christian Spain, it's not Islamic Spain, and that is Yitzhak Abarbanel. It's called Don Yitzhak Abarbanel. He's a member of the Spanish nobility, or of Ravenel. It's pronounced in various ways. And the Abarbanel, of course, is known for his, he had many, many careers. He was, first of all, finance minister to Ferdinand and Isabella as they were financing Columbus going to the New World, or going to India, whatever Columbus was planning on doing. He bumped into this continent. And what happened was that when the Jews were ordered to be expelled from Spain in 1492, the Abarbanel, called the Abarbanel, but Rav Abarbanel, was given permission. He was the one Jew who would be allowed to remain in Spain without having to convert, simply because he could raise money. He was a good fundraiser and a good manager of money. As you would expect, however, as befitting a Jewish leader, he refused to accept that type of condition, and he went into exile with all of the other Jewish people at the 9th of Av, in that particular year. It's interesting, just to give you a sense of Jewish history, he was already towards the end of his life, after a very illustrious career in politics and Torah learning, but there was a 4-year-old child in his mother's arms among the Jews who were expelled from Spain. And that 4-year-old child later became Rabbi Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, who already moved to Israel, went to Turkey and then to Israel, etc. No, not his brother, no, just saying that he was a 4-year-old child. The same time, in other words, the Barbanel and the Yosef Karo are both in that same line, as it were, going.
This was in 1492,
Rabbi? Well, they could go wherever they wanted.
Where did the Barbanel go?
The Barbanel went to Italy. Mm-hmm. Yes, and in fact, it's very interesting that the Abarbanel wrote many of his, in fact, after he got out of politics, leaving Spain, he was able to do a lot of writing, because he was retired, basically. And his biblical commentaries contain a lot of personal autobiographical information. So, for example, just to give you an example of how his life influenced his understanding of things, one of the biblical questions that the commentaries deal with is the role of a monarchy in the Jewish tradition. Everyone knows the famous question. God says in the book of Deuteronomy, when you come to Israel, you're supposed to have a king. It seems to be a commandment. Appoint for yourselves a king. And then we find in the book of Samuel, when the people come and ask for a king, Samuel gives them a whole speech asking for a king. What's wrong with God? Are you rejecting God? Etc. Right, so one of the biblical problems that the commentaries deal with is it good to have a king or not good to have a king? Right? What's wrong with that? So Maimonides, for example, gives his answer. Maimonides says, well, a monarchy is good, but they weren't asking in the right way. They were asking to have like all the nations of the world, and let's have a king like the Goyim have, etc. In other words, it was a question of motive and the way they asked. Okay. But the Abarbanel
is unique among all the commentaries in saying monarchies are rotten. He says, monarchies are no good, they concentrate power, they lead to abuses. What you ought to have is representative government who are accountable to an electorate with term limits.
Mm-hmm.
He says, there ought to be term limits. No, but more than that, term limits after the term, because then when you know you can only be a boss for 4 years, then you're going to be very, very careful that your decisions don't alienate your populations. Because, and he writes, and he says, and I know what I'm talking about, because I lived in Spain, and I saw what an absolute monarch can do to his people. And now I'm in Italy. Italy at that time had the city-states, Florence and Milan and Genoa, and they had apparently rotating systems of government and city councils, and he says, this is far superior government. So there's an, in fact, if you wanted to find a statement about political philosophy in rabbinic literature, it's really the most extended discussion on political philosophy in rabbinic literature. Now, what's fascinating is, Abravanel takes that position, even though that is contrary to the Talmud's own interpretation. The Talmud itself posits that establishing of a monarchy is a divine commandment. The Abravanel says, no, it isn't. The Abravanel actually says, God is saying, if you want a king, you can have it. But it's a lot better not to have it. So it's interesting that the Abravanel takes that position. But be it as it may, yeah. Well, no, because the Abravanel, in fact, the Abravanel wrote many books about Melech and Mashiach. So right. That's an exception. He says, when you have a king that God, you know, puts into place, that's a separate thing. But, yeah.
For those of us who are teachers, yes. And I know you often talk about that, would then Abravanel be a good person to quote when we talk about Thanksgiving for kids? The American Thanksgiving?
What connection are you making? I want to show you.
On the idea of democracy.
Oh, okay, Barbadel has a nice essay on technically Republican government, not democracy is our meeting,
okay.
But yeah, Republican form of government. Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, it's very interesting because there are very few statements which are actively pro democracy or pro Republican in that sense. But the Barbadel wrote biblical commentaries, and the Barbadel had a very unique style. The Barbadel style is, he takes a chapter and he gives you a list of questions after questions. He'll give you 50 or 20, 30, 40, 50 questions.
Mm.
And then he'll give you an explanation that is supposed to answer all of these questions. They even tell the story about the person who liked to learn Abravanel's commentary. So Friday night after the meal, he sat in his easy chair and he read the Abravanel that he fell asleep. And he said he became an apikoris later because he said he read 50 questions against the Torah, but he fell asleep before I played. So many questions, I can't believe it anymore. And so you have to be careful. When there are too many questions, you got to be sure you get to the answer. And it is unfortunate. The Abravanel is an extremely extremely long writer. Extremely long. In other words, he's very, very, which we call arichut, and therefore it's sometimes difficult. And he says very, very beautiful things, but it's sometimes difficult to get to the end of it. So one has to be careful about this. But in addition to his biblical interpretations, he was also a great philosopher in his own right, a philosopher. He wrote a commentary on the Moreh Nevuchim, or the Guide to the Perplexed. And he was especially interested, though, his special love was Jewish eschatology. Eschatology meaning the study of the Messianic era, resurrection of the dead, and the like. Probably, again, he was probably attracted to it, because he had seen such devastation in his lifetime that this caused him to want to discuss and learn and teach the foundations about the coming of Mashiach. So one of the great expositions of Messianism, again based on rabbinic teachings, but he developed it into a whole school, are the works of the Abravanel. The Abravanel does this both in his biblical commentary. He wrote a commentary to the book of Daniel, which is devoted to Mashiach, and separate works about Mashiach. And as was pointed out, it's kind of paradoxical on one level, because he was generally anti-monarchist, and yet the Mashiach books talk about the Malchut Beit David that are going to be established. So we would have to say that the Abravanel already is kind of the high watermark of the rational philosophical tradition. And already in the Abravanel, we don't see really innovation and creativity. We kind of see summation and elaboration of the existing themes. There's like nothing relatively new in this, but kind of, just like in music, the end of a period essentially summarizes and brings together all that came before. From the Abravanel's time afterwards, however, there tend to be new influences. I'll explain what I mean by new in a moment. New is also old. But there tends to be a new influence that is being articulated and being acted upon, and that is the powerful influence of Jewish mysticism or Kabbalah. Now, by when I say something is new, we of course do not mean it was invented in the 1500s. That's not the point. Kabbalah is a body of mystical understandings that go all the way back to Adam and Abraham and the like, but it was kept relatively secret, relatively limited. But the notion of popularizing it, the notion of spreading it, the notion of exposing wide numbers of people to it, first really took roots in the aftermath of the Spanish Inquisition. And the reason it's connected to that was, as we do find, that as people were yearning for redemption, and as they saw, the Spanish Inquisition was their Holocaust, in a sense, they were seeking answers. And the old rationalistic systems did not always give answers for these cosmic questions. And then the history of Jewish philosophy took a decidedly non-rationalistic bent to exploring various mystic perspectives and the like. And therefore, consequently, there were figures who tried to combine mysticism and rationalistic philosophy. Among the two figures, most prominent, are the Maharal of Prague. The Maharal lived in the 1500s. Maharal is an abbreviation. Moreno, our teacher, Harab Lev, Master Lev, his name is Yehuda Lev, or Levi. And the Maharal's works, again, very, very difficult, but essentially, the Maharal draws on Kabbalistic ideas, but he combines them with philosophical. In fact, many of the Maharal's terms, the Maharal always talks about Chomer and Sura, matter and form. And people think, and again, Maharal has many, many innovative ideas. People think, oh, this is the Maharal's, you know, innovative idea of matter and form. That is not a Maharal innovation at all. That is a standard term that is used in every single work on medieval philosophy. But the Maharal uses these terms to create his philosophy and understanding of Judaism. So the Maharal is really an attempt to combine the rationalistic stream and the Kabbalistic stream. And the other figure who's a little later than the Maharal is Rav Utsato, the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Utsato, lived in Amsterdam, Italy, and then Amsterdam. Also a great, great mystic.
What is his name?
Yeah, Moshe Chaim Lutzato. It's often abbreviated Ramchal. Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato. He authored The Path of the Just and other works. And these are, again, obviously I'm being very simplistic here, but this was an attempt to combine philosophy and Kabbalah. But that's why you will find that philosophy gradually wanes. Of course, it got revived in the non-traditional segment of the Jewish people, meaning to say that those philosophers who eventually rejected mitzvot and Torah, like Spinoza, kept that philosophical tradition alive, but eventually it got more or less severed from formal religious thought. In other words, Jewish philosophy no longer remained Jewish. It became Jews who were into general philosophy. Jewish philosophy metamorphosed much more so into channels of mysticism and channels of Chassidut, which is really a popularization of Kabbalah. So really, after the Abravanel, a Jewish philosophical tradition really became less and less prominent as Kabbalah became more and more significant as a component of Jewish thoughts. Now, once again, as I say, Kabbalah is not totally different than philosophy. I mean, it deals with matters in a different plane, but there are figures who try to bridge the two disciplines. I'm sorry, yeah.
I realize that the
Ramchal
was rejected in this time.
Yeah.
Absolutely. What about the Maharal? Is the Maharal accepted? Because his style of writing is very similar in some ways to the Ramchal.
Yeah. Now the Maharal, by the way, although it's very, very clear that the Maharal draws extensively from mysticism.